loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, as demonstrations continue across the country, including the occupation in Portland, Oregon, of an ICE facility, controversy continues to swirl over the fate of detained families and asylum seekers. Will the children really be reunited with their parents? Is the Trump administration considering even more draconian anti-immigrant measures? Next, in a 5-4 decision today, the Supreme Court ruled that police need a warrant to access cell phone location data. We'll talk about what this means for the fight against mass surveillance and police misconduct. Then, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley branded as, quote, patently ridiculous, misleading, and politically motivated, unquote, a U.N. report condemning entrenched poverty in the United States. She added that the U.N. should be focused on countries like Rwanda and Burundi instead. And then, global oil prices were sharply lower on Thursday and sharply higher on Friday as OPEC ministers moved toward an agreement to keep production low. Iran and Venezuela had argued for lower output to keep prices high. And finally, again this week, we'll look at the worst and most misleading headlines. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. And now we turn to the immigration debate. As demonstrations continue across the country, including an occupation in Portland, Oregon, of an ICE facility, controversy continues to swirl over the fate of detained families and asylum seekers. Will the children really be reunited with their parents? Is the Trump administration considering even more draconian anti-immigrant measures? We're joined from Chicago by Angie Kim. She's the Community Engagement and Advocacy Coordinator for NACASEC, the National Korean American Service and Education Consortium. And we're also joined from Philadelphia by David Benyon. He's an immigration lawyer and executive director of the Free Migration Project. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
David, let's begin with you. We're seeing actions all around the country, not just demonstrations, but as I noted in the intro, this takeover in Portland, Oregon, of an ICE facility. Just a couple of hours ago, demonstrators were picketing and protesting in front of Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen's home in Alexandria, Virginia, and she can't get out. She's actually stuck inside the house. So people are taking this immigration situation very, very seriously. How do you see this playing out in the coming weeks? Do you think we're going to see real changes in the policy? Do you think we're going to see children reunited with their parents?
I certainly hope so. And it's been interesting to me, having worked on these issues, as I'm sure Angie has, for several years, seeing the amazing public attention and outcry against family separation, which really has taken the nation by storm, and shows the depths to which this administration has gone to demonize and punish immigrants. As far as long-lasting policy changes, well, we saw that the Trump administration backed off somewhat on this very harsh family separation, but it's very problematic the way that they're doing it. First of all, they've not taken measures to reunite the families that have already been separated. Secondly, we believe that some family separation will continue to happen, as it has to a lesser degree in the past. But thirdly, and probably most importantly, the solution that they propose is just to lock up the families indefinitely on a much greater scale than we've seen before, which really just compounds the problems.
Angie Kim, you know, up until now, and there's confusion about what this executive order will mean, children could not be detained for more than 20 days. Now it may be that children can be locked up indefinitely with their locked up parents also indefinitely until their process comes to a conclusion. The demands can't be simply reunite with the parents who are incarcerated. There has to be some other form, some other method, some goal of real justice here for asylum seekers.
Absolutely. And this has been a challenging and very important response in terms of getting the facts straight, right? And that is that the Trump administration is not resolving the issues around families being separated, families being detained, children being kept in detention camps, as they proclaim to do. So It's very clear that this new executive order, number one, does nothing about the administration's cruel zero tolerance policy. It's still being implemented. It prosecutes anyone fleeing their country, seeking safety and asylum at the ports of entry. The executive order does nothing to reunite more than 2,300 children who have already been ripped away from their families. And it's a matter of what will happen to these children and what will happen to their parents. And as you've mentioned and David did, the executive order calls for what's this indefinite detention of immigrants. And frankly, from the Asian American communities and our historical perspective, this resonates so well. And this is a replication of Japanese internment camps. And this type of funding for a new facility and this policy will actually keep children for longer periods of time that is unknown. It could be months and years in detention camps. So this is absolutely not a solution.
Well, I wanted to ask about that, actually. There doesn't seem to be any kind of a quick solution. David, what are the logistics of reuniting people who have been spread all over the country? When a federal judge pointed out yesterday that when you go to prison for committing a crime, you hand over your wallet and your watch and they give you a receipt. In this case, you hand over your child and you get nothing.
Right. And it's been a logistical bungle by the administration, but compounded by the fact that this was their intention all along. They don't want these families to be together. And so they've not taken measures to be able to successfully reunite the families. But it should be something that they can do if there's the political will. Because they know where these children are. They know where the parents are. Even for those parents who've been deported, the U.S. government is in constant contact with these countries of origins, their government. They're always asking them for travel documents and passports to deport their nationals. So why can they not communicate with those governments to reunite these families? I should also mention a quick point on family detention. It's been ongoing for the last 4 years. It's not something new. There's been around 3,000 individuals in family units detained at any given time in three facilities around the country, including one in Pennsylvania. And so what we're seeing and what we're afraid of is a massive expansion of that. The 20-day rule, so-called, has not been honored at all by the federal government, and there's no reason to believe that it will be honored in the future.
We have the Pentagon. It's a really something. This week, the Congress passed a new $82 billion extra over last year so-called defense budget. The real numbers are getting up to about $1 trillion, perhaps over $1 trillion. And now, Angie, the Pentagon is saying, okay, well, look, we'll start building camps or using or reformatting already existing military bases so we can start to incarcerate children and their parents on U.S. military bases. It's incredible.
It absolutely is, and it's appalling and such a to our value and humanity, not just for Americans, but for the world. I mean, you know, this is a matter that's been observed by countries around the world, and it's really shameful. And I've mentioned this, and I foresee if this type of enforcement and detention and treatment of children and families continue, we're just going to see our communities being militarized, our innocent people being detained in military camps. This is, first of all, I mean, as I've mentioned, these families are not a threat to the national security. This is not a matter of national security. This is a matter of in which America treats families and people who are displaced, people who are seeking refuge. And the way we are treating this is very inhumane and cruel. I can't imagine detaining and locking children up in military camps. It's appalling. It's not right. It's simply wrong.
So what does Congress do next? The Republicans can't agree on a bill even within their own caucus. The Democrats are cut out of the process.
And not doing anything anyway.
So what happens? How can the government, as a government, help these families?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, what we need right now is we need the Congress, Republicans and Democrats, to really come together and face the challenges of this issue and find a viable, humane, compassionate solution. And what that looks like is, number one, we need a permanent solution for immigrant youth and temporary protected holders who've lost their status without harming other members of the community or bargaining their lives. You know, deferred action is a program that was ended by the Trump administration. As I've said, this is a crisis that was created by the White House. And so they have the power and the Congress to reverse this and do the right thing. Number two, they have to cut funding for these agencies such as ICE and CBP that, you know, detain and deport innocent people. And we need to defund this type of hatred. And lastly, you know, what we need is a freedom for immigrants. You know, we oppose any type of legislative proposals or bills that will separate families, legal family-based visas and petitions and incarceration of families in all types of form, whether it's in the border or in our backyards. So what we need is we need Congress to come together and find a bill that will reflect these points and reflect the values of America, of human dignity. That's what we need.
That was the voice of Angie Kim. She joined us from Chicago. She is the Community Engagement and Advocacy Coordinator for NACASEC, the National Korean American Service and Education Consortium. And we were also joined from Philadelphia by David Bennion. He's an immigration lawyer and executive director of the Free Migration Project. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. In a 5-4 decision today, the Supreme Court ruled that police need a warrant to access cell phone location data. We'll talk about what this means for the fight against mass surveillance and police misconduct. We're joined from Washington by Chip Gibbons. He's a policy and legislative counsel for Defending Rights and Dissent, as well as a journalist. Welcome back, Chip.
Always good to be on Loud and Clear.
Thank you, Chip. Chip, I was in prison with a whole bunch of guys who were there because the cops used locational data information from their cell phones. This vote, this decision by the Supreme Court seems to me at first glance to be a great victory for privacy. How do you see it?
It is a great victory for privacy. It's unfortunately a very narrow decision, but nonetheless, in this case, it is an important victory for privacy. So starting in the 1960s, the court recognized that the Fourth Amendment didn't just protect your property, it also protected privacy, and that if you did things to take action, to make your actions private and society considered them objectively reasonable, whatever that means, then a Fourth Amendment search would happen if the government violated that. They also, shortly after that, though, began articulating this idea of a third-party doctrine, which means if you give business records to a third party, you don't have a Fourth Amendment interest in them. So they can go to a bank and subpoena your bank records because they're supposedly not your records or the bank's records. In this case, you know, the records were with the cell phone company. The defendant in it, Timothy Carpenter, was accused of robbing a Radio Shack and a T-Mobile store. And the government went to his cell phone provider, got his cell phone records, and were able to pinpoint his location over a 107-day period and place him in the vicinity of the crime. And the government said, you know, these are just third-party records. But the majority of the court, while declining to overturn the third-party doctrine, did state that, I mean, there was an exceptional privacy interest in these documents because it's your location information and it gives government sort of a perfect total surveillance of you to have this type of information. So it's an important step. I wish they had gone further. It's, you know, extremely narrow ruling. It doesn't apply to anything else besides cell phone location data. Which, I mean, obviously there's a lot of questions about what if the government subpoenas your emails from Gmail or your Google search history, something like that. And it would be nice to have a decision that firmly puts that in the Fourth Amendment protected area, but the court likes ruling very narrowly and avoiding the main issue.
And Chip, the FBI frequently uses something called a national security letter rather than a warrant to collect this kind of data or metadata. Is that going to change with this decision?
I'm not sure about that, especially since the decision would not apply to metadata generally. I mean, metadata is still theoretically an unresolved issue. I mean, one of the initial third-party cases dealt with pen registers, which is a device that clicks or records every cell phone, or not cell phone number, it was 1979, every regular phone called and, you know, would record the numbers you had called. And the court found that that did not have it. You did not have an interest in privacy in that. And that's where a lot of the arguments for metadata not being protected by the Fourth Amendment come from. Of course, a pen register is extremely different than, you know, the NSA sucking up all your metadata, but we've never really had a ruling on that. So we don't, I don't know. I mean, like I said, they ruled very narrowly. So I think it certainly opens the door to challenging a lot of the mass surveillance practices, but it's not necessarily a slam dunk prediction of how the court will go. I certainly hope they would overturn those things. I mean, obviously I wish they would have a robust defense of Fourth Amendment privacy rights, but I don't usually hold out hope when the Supreme Court is involved.
You said that this was a narrowly written decision. So does it affect, or how does it affect people who are already in prison, who are there because of evidence that was used them in court collected by the FBI without a warrant?
I would imagine that if they had evidence that was based on cell phone location data found through cell phone records, similar to in this case, and it was found that that was a determinant factor in their sentences, they would have ground to challenge their convictions. I'm not entirely certain how this will play out, but I cannot imagine you get a similar situation, why it wouldn't apply to you.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But it would have to be directly the same situation. It would have to be the same type of cell phone records because it's so narrow. It's just this one type of data you can't get without a warrant.
The ruling was 5-4, Chip. Anything interesting about that?
It was interesting because the dissents were sort of pointing out, I mean, they were sort of like close but no potato moments, as they say on the Twitter, in that they kept pointing out that, you know, other types of records are as sensitive as cell phone location records, and why does the Fourth Amendment not apply to those records, but it does apply to these records. Of course, the correct line of reasoning is you're right, and the third-party information doctrine was wrongly decided. The Fourth Amendment is more robust as opposed to the decision or the wish of the dissent to limit it further. But it was interesting, particularly since a number of people who joined in the case, majority decision about the GPS tracking device on the car, found that to be a search, did not find cell phone records to be a search. And what's really interesting about the dissent is a number of people, including Thomas, including Gorsuch, are really very interested in overturning the 1960s Supreme Court decision, Katz v. United States, which basically moved the Fourth Amendment away from only protecting property and moved it to protecting privacy. Thomas is very explicit in his dissent. The Fourth Amendment should not protect your privacy, just your property.
You know, we're seeing some strange bedfellows lately in the Supreme Court, even in Congress. You know, I was looking at this defense vote in the Senate today, and Mike Lee, a Republican of Utah, was one of the no votes, as was Rand Paul, a Republican of Kentucky. And I wonder if people in the Congress and people on the court are starting to change their positions on privacy and whether or not there is actually a constitutional right to privacy.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I feel like in the decades preceding the Katz decision in the 60s, it was pretty well recognized in the Supreme Court that you had a Fourth Amendment right to privacy. And a number of the people on the dissent from the right wing of the court want to take us back before 1966. So I'm not sure that type of progress is being made in the Supreme Court. It would be nice if it was. And I do know in the past, you know, Scalia, who was usually on the right, had a number of very good Fourth Amendment opinions, though he also often used not particularly helpful reasoning. He did come out on the right side of the vote. it's possible. I mean, Roberts joined with the four most liberal judges on the court, but then Kennedy joined with the four most conservative judges, or three most conservative, I'm sorry. So it is, there is some interesting mix here.
Yeah, and each of them, each of the four wrote their own dissent against the majority
they
opinion.
Did.
So they have different agendas, a momentary congruence or conjunctural agreement. You know, when we think about privacy, you know, it's really amazing, I think, because most American people, most people here in the United States, if asked, if you ask them, do you have a constitutional right to privacy? They would think, oh, yes, of course we have the constitutional. It's like a bedrock of, it's a bedrock of like cherished freedoms in democracy. But Chip, it's not true.
No.
I mean, the court has found you have a constitutional right to privacy. They've done so consistently since the 1960s. It's just a handful of people on the right of the court in this case seemed really interested in moving away from that, which is surprising to me because it seems like a well-established opinion. So I would not fault most Americans for believing something that seemed, you know, to be a well-established opinion to be true. What's interesting about the dissents is just how embolden what would be sort of fringe right theories at one point are now, and that people are moving in this really sort of reactionary direction, just taking us back before the 1960s, which, you know, people like this would, I don't think, would have been taken seriously a decade or two ago.
It's really something. A half century after where we have the rise of the national surveillance state, where by one means or another, by hook or by crook, so to speak, there are these assaults against basic rights to privacy, and it's always for a good cause. It's always to catch a bad guy.
Always.
And that's why I think it's really important to sort of vigorously, robustly explain over and over again why if the government is able to take these basic cherished rights away and give them over to law enforcement isn't about stopping crime per se. It's really about getting its way whenever they've initiated the targeting of somebody.
Yeah, and this is the way that they chip at our civil liberties, just a little bit at a time, one court decision at a time. And the next thing you know, you can't do something that you could have done 10 years ago.
40 seconds left, Chip. Take us out.
I mean, that's sort of the direction of sort of, you know, the court for the last 50 years. They made a number of landmark, very robust decisions that pushed the ball in the right direction in terms of civil liberties, recognizing rights they had not previously recognized. But then in the, you know, intervening decades, they've just chipped away and made exceptions at them. So now finally the right can come back and, you know, want to do away with those rights completely.
I think that's it. We're out of time. We were joined from Washington by Chip Gibbons. Chip is a policy and legislative counsel for Defending Rights and Dissent, and he's also a journalist. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley branded as, quote, patently ridiculous, misleading, and politically motivated, unquote, a U.N. report condemning entrenched poverty in the United States. She added that the U.N. should be focused on countries like Rwanda and Burundi instead. We're joined by Ajamu Baraka. He is the national organizer of Black Alliance for Peace and a longtime human rights and political activist and organizer. And he was the 2016 Green Party nominee for vice president of the United States. And we're also joined from Chicago by Aislinn Pulley, an organizer with the Black Lives Matter movement. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This report is an official United Nations report. It's actually quite extensively researched, and I'd actually like to read a paragraph. And this goes to the heart of what Nikki Haley is complaining about. She says that the report is ridiculous, that poverty in the United States, if it even exists, should not be an issue taken up by the United Nations. But here's what the report found. It says there is considerable debate over the extent of poverty in the United States, but the present report relies principally upon official government statistics, especially from the United States Census Bureau. It defines and quantifies poverty in America based on poverty thresholds or official poverty measures updated each year. These thresholds have been used since President Lyndon B. Johnson's war on poverty in the 1960s and use a set of dollar value thresholds that vary by family size and composition to determine who is in poverty. Following much criticism of the official poverty measures, the Census Bureau developed a supplemental poverty measure, which is preferred by many experts. According to the official poverty measures, in 2016, 12.7% of Americans were living in poverty. According to the supplemental poverty measure, the figure was 14%. So what's the basis for a complaint about that?
That's 70 million people. And of course,
70 million
if you talk
people.
About people near poverty, you can double that. Anyway, Ajamu, let's start with you. Your reaction.
Well, I think that the stats really speak for themselves. And it is reflective of a real concern within the context of human rights law. What Haley is referring to in terms of trying to divert attention away from that devastating report is the fact that the U.S. does not recognize economic, social, and cultural rights as, in fact, human rights. But Philip Alston and his mandate as a special rapporteur is required to have a comprehensive analysis of human rights practices of all states. So the fact that the U.S. Is in violation of all of the terms of the international covenant on economic, social, and cultural rights is, in fact, the real source of the issue that Haley has.
Yeah, Aislinn, let's bring you in. Again, this is what the rapporteur says, and it's just along the lines of what Ajamu is saying. Quote, "The United States is alone among developed countries in insisting that while human rights are of fundamental importance, they do not include rights that guard against dying of hunger, dying from a lack of access to affordable health care, or growing up in a context of total deprivation." I mean, these are a true report. I mean, really true and absolutely accurate about how the U.S. functions. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's extremely accurate, and I think it's revealing to those who haven't been paying attention. I think, you know, I'm in Chicago, and Chicago, in many cases, has been a leader in terms of the attack on the poor. Rahm Emanuel conducted the largest public school closing in the history of the United States by closing over 50 schools. Rahm Emanuel closed half of the city's mental health care centers. All of these things that have been attacks to services for the people and to the public good have resulted in increased poverty and all of the consequences that result from poverty, including increases in intra-communal violence. And what we've seen systemically is that instead of addressing the causes of economic inequality, which of course includes the behemoth of capitalism and all the services that exist within it, it also is further impacted by removing services from communities. And that has caused the increase in violence. And we've seen that from the increase in street violence in Chicago, the increase in mass school shootings. This is a total betrayal of the societal agreement between the government and its people. And we're seeing the social welfare of entire populations throughout this country impacted on a level that we haven't seen since the Great Depression.
One of the points that the report highlights is that the United States has the highest rate of income inequality among Western countries. The $1.5 trillion in tax cuts in December 2017 overwhelmingly benefited the wealthy and worsened the inequality. It says the United States ranks 18th out of 21 wealthy countries in terms of labor markets, poverty rates, safety nets, wealth inequality, and economic mobility. And in 2018, the United States had 25%, that's one out of four, of the world's 2,208 billionaires. It's really, Ajamu, in spite of all of the Democratic sort of branding, it's a tale of two countries. There is the very, very, very rich, and then a vast part of the population that's actually very, very poor.
You know, that's exactly right. And that's why it's so problematic when you see how this report is being covered by the mainstream press. They are framing this as a report critical of Trump-era policies. But we know, because we were in contact with Alston and his team during 2017, and we know reality, that this report is an analysis of the structural contradictions within the U.S. that preceded the Trump administration. That basically what we're looking at is the consequences of neoliberal policies that have been supported by both of the bourgeois parties. And the social and economic consequences are quite obvious and reflective in that report. So this notion that this is a consequence of Trump policies is a gross distortion, and is really helping to undermine where the attention of this report really should be, which is on the structural contradictions of this backward, racist, neoliberal capitalist system.
You know, one of the things that struck me too about this report was its contention that American society right now is structured in such a way that it's actually undermining our foundation of democracy, where we like to talk about one man, one vote. We like to talk about the fact that we're a participatory democracy. But in fact, we have among the lowest voter turnout of any industrialized democratic nation on earth. And so there really isn't one man, one vote here in the United States. And people who are marginalized economically are also marginalized politically. And so the poorer they get, the weaker they get, and it's a vicious cycle.
Right. The homeless have the right to vote every 2 or 4 years, but they don't have the right to a home.
Right. And if you don't have an address, you can't vote anyway.
Yeah. Aislinn, go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I think it, you know, it reveals the delusion of, you know, American exceptionalism. And it exposes the contradiction between the rhetoric and the reality. The reality is that we have never had one man or one person, one vote, right? There's always been exceptions. There have been exceptions to who was considered human and who was considered property. There was exceptions to gender, right? Women only were able to win the vote less than 100 years ago. And then full access to voting rights were not obtained until, you know, the late 60s, you know, for black people. And then we still receive a huge negative impact from the fact that there are so many of our people locked up who cannot vote. And so there are so many ways in which the vote, you know, the reality shows us that that we have never had one person, one vote in this country. And there have been consistent and persistent efforts to make sure that that does not happen. We have the Electoral College, which is a vestige of slavery that still is in place, which prevents a direct democratic vote. And I think all of that is reflected in the reasons why. And this report highlights that the United States is incredibly unequal, and it is set up that way. And in order to maintain its inequality and to maintain the dominance of the billionaire class, all of these provisions are put in place.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of attention right now. We have about 2 minutes left. There's a lot of attention paid by the media right now about children and children separated from their parents. But this report, which is, again, based on 2016, just as Ajamu was saying, this was while Obama is still president. In 2016, nearly 20% of all children were living in poverty. Children comprised 32% of all people in poverty. 20% of children live in relative income poverty. And contrary to stereotypical assumptions, 31% of poor children are white, 24% are black, 36% are Latino, and 1% are indigenous. That is consistent with the fact that the United States ranks 25th out of 29 industrialized nations in investing in early childhood education. Ajamu, it's not about Trump. This is the system. You're absolutely right.
Exactly. And what's important about this conversation is for people to understand that all of these issues are, in fact, human rights issues. And while we are looking at economic, social, and cultural rights, the fact of the matter also, too, is that the U.S. is in violation of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, moving child offenders to adult prisons, the use of deadly force, the impunity of the police officers, the death penalty for child offenders. This all amounts to a conclusion that's quite clear to most of us, that the U.S. is a systematic violator of the fundamental human rights of people in this country.
That was the voice of Ajamu Baraka. He is the national organizer of Black Alliance for Peace and a longtime human rights and political activist and organizer, and he was the 2016 Green Party nominee for Vice President of the United States. And we were also joined from Chicago by Aislinn Pulley, an organizer with the Black Lives Matter movement. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Global oil prices were sharply lower on Thursday and then sharply higher on Friday as OPEC ministers moved toward an agreement to keep production low. Iran, Russia, and Venezuela had argued for lower output to keep prices higher. We're joined from California by Dr. Jack Rasmus, a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California and author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. He's also the author of an article in the World Review of Political Economy titled Trump's Deja Vu, China Trade War. Jack, welcome back.
My pleasure.
So what are we supposed to take from this? Prices are up, prices are down, there's discord inside OPEC. How is this different from any other OPEC meeting?
Okay, the first thing is to understand that global crude oil output is really driven by three sources. One is the U.S., which is about 10 billion barrels, Russia about the same, and OPEC about the same. These are the three big forces in global oil crude production. Now, Russia is already cheating and producing more, even though it had a sort of a quasi-agreement with OPEC. And, of course, the U.S. and the oil frackers just continue to produce more oil. So the supplies are growing because of Russia and the United States. And now OPEC wants to get some of that money as well, particularly Saudi Arabia, whose economy is kind of shaky, and they want to generate more oil income. But you got to realize that the price of oil is not driven by the supply of oil. The price of oil is driven by oil speculators. In no short term does the supply move enough or the demand for oil move enough. And the demand, by the way, is, in the near future is questionable as the global economy begins to slow down. It's not supply and demand, not even the supply of oil that drives it. It's global futures commodities oil speculators that drive the price of oil in the short term.
I did not know that.
Yes, that's really, the amount of supply of oil does not change that fast. And the demand is actually slipping a bit. So how do you explain oil prices going from where they were at $35, $40 a barrel a couple of years ago to $65, $70 a barrel? And then, of course, in 2014, it was $150 a barrel. Well, it has nothing really to do in the short run with supply and demand. It's all about these oil speculators. Oil became a commodity future and therefore a financial security after 1999 and the deregulation of the oil futures commodities trading, thanks to Bill Clinton, of course. And what we got now is oil is a security, a financial security. And the speculators buy and sell contracts on futures of oil and drive the price up or drive the price down in the short run. Really doesn't matter what's going on with Iran and OPEC and so forth.
And the Chinese economy. I remember reading an article saying that prices had fallen because the Chinese were going into a recession. So it's really all speculation, isn't it?
Yes. Well, if they think China's going into a recession, then there'll be less China demand. And then the price of the futures contracts fluctuate up or down, you see.
Let me just ask you, Jack, because I think it's an important point that you're making, but to try to dissect and actually understand what it means. If speculators, rather than demand or supply, are the driving force for oil prices, is their speculation purely arbitrary? Is it just suspended in air? Or is it based on anticipation with supply and demand?
The latter. It's based on anticipation, right? But the actual supply or demand may change very slowly in the very short run, but it's the expectation, the U.S. economy is booming, therefore the demand, in the next year is going to increase for oil, let's anticipate the future demand and raise our prices.
I have a follow-up question then. So it's not completely arbitrary. It's based on an anticipation of where things are going. Is it also, as happens frequently in speculation, simply gambling?
Well, sometimes it is very much so. It's like, the stock market or derivatives markets or whatever. Speculative investing is investing in a commodity or in a financial market in expectation that the price will be larger or higher, rather, in the future. It's a price expectation-driven demand, which drives the price up. Speculation is always based upon price appreciation expectations. And that's the same whether you're talking about the stock market. I mean, why is the stock market going up or not going down when the economy is not that great? Well, that's because of all the stock buybacks and dividend payouts, you know, over $1 trillion a year now for 5 years in the U.S., the stock buybacks and dividend payouts. And this year, because of the Trump windfall tax cut for the 1%, is going to go to $1.3 trillion in buybacks of stock and dividend payouts. Well, that money is expected to go into the stock market. Therefore, prices appreciate based on speculation.
Well, let me ask you one more follow-up question. Again, we are the lay public. Does the problem of speculation seems to be a representation of a surplus. There is a surplus of cash, a surplus of liquidity, a surplus of money that's not being invested, say, in real things like building new buildings or repairing bridges or building highways or all of the real commodities that human beings use. So not invested in real things. It's used then as a crapshoot, as a gambling financialized instrument. Again, anticipating supply and demand in this case in for oil futures, it could be about any other commodity too. But it's a representation of surplus, and it's so odd that you have surplus cash that can be gambled with. At the same time, there's so much unmet human need.
Yes. Well, you know, in my 2016 book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, I addressed just this question. Why do we have a shift of financial asset investments going on and a slowing down of investing, as you say, in real assets, you know, plant, equipment, job creation, and so forth? That's going on. We have this financial investment shift going on for decades now and accelerating. And why? Because there is so much liquidity having been pumped into the economy by the central banks, including the Federal Reserve Bank. There is trillions of dollars sitting on the sidelines. And why is it going to financial asset investing? Because it's more profitable in the short run than investing in making things. You know, longer term, you got to hire people, you got to buy supply and materials and goods and so forth. Whereas if you jump into this new financial asset global market, you can jump in and jump out and move your money around. You see, there are about 200,000 globally of what I call the new finance capital elite. And they are so flush with cash and liquidity. And all they do is move their money around and bet on price movements and all these liquid financial markets globally. And oil is just one of them. Oil futures is just one of them.
It's a hallmark of a system that seems to me to be in decay. I mean, there's a foundational decadence to this where there's surplus money held by some part of the population, very small part, and their institutions like the biggest banks. They don't know really what to do with it, so they're gambling in oil futures or in other commodities. They're speculating. Meanwhile, the other part of the economy, also known as people, you know, like average people, our communities, our cities, our towns, are cash strapped. There's a desperate, you know, people are deciding, well, we're not going to finance a healthcare, we'll finance something else, maybe education, because, you know, there's just not money. And yet there's all this money. There's just so much money and nothing to invest in with a guarantee of profit that it's used for gambling.
Yeah, that's really what it is. Jack, isn't it true that the last time oil went up to something like $200 a barrel, that airlines were actually engaging in this kind of hedging and gambling and then ended up losing their shirts when the price of oil came back down again?
Yeah, it was about $150 a barrel in 2013-14. Exactly. Well, you know, what you've noted is that large multinational corporations who appear to be making things are actually a form of shadow bank. You know, most of your multinational corporations, General Electric and all that, one third of their total profits comes from financial investments. They are a kind of speculative bank. And that's true increasingly as the global capitalist economy becomes increasingly financialized. The pursuit of financial asset markets and financial profits becomes greater relative weight in their whole portfolio of investment. This is a significant change in global capitalism going on, and it results in a concentration of income in a smaller and smaller group. And we keep feeding them. The politicians keep feeding them more and more money. For 8 years, it was the central bank feeding them free money. Now it's shifted to fiscal policy and Trump giving them $5 trillion more. And they're still wanting to cut more taxes on the investors. You know, the Trump tax cut really gave $5 trillion to businesses and investors, $2 trillion increase in the middle class taxes, and then some phony estimations about the growth of the economy. And all you hear about is, oh, it's only $1.5 trillion. No, it's $5 trillion they gave to the rich. And they still want to give them even more now.
Yeah, it seems to be the pattern of things, at least with this Congress and this White House. We're joined from California by Dr. Jack Rasmus. He's a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California and author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. And he's the author of an article in the World Review of Political Economy entitled Trump's Deja Vu China Trade War. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Again this week, we'll look at the worst and most misleading headlines. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefteye.blogspot.com. And we're joined in studio by Loud and Clear producer Nicole Russell. Welcome back, both of you.
Thank you.
We have breaking news, John, and
go right to the breaking news.
Let's go to breaking news with some Market Watch headlines, Steve. Let's hear them.
Well, this is a wonderful pair of headlines. This was yesterday's headline. Global oil prices drop as OPEC appears close to deal on higher output. Today's headline, same output, same media outlet, Market Watch. Oil prices climb as OPEC moves towards OPEC output deal. So, believe what you want to believe, I guess.
Okay, I guess we can call yesterday's headline misleading because they've completely reversed it today. Okay, what else do we got?
Well, I know you did a whole show on James Mattis earlier in the week with Mark Sloboda, but we have to repeat the headline from the article that highlighted his speech. And the headline reads as follows. Mattis slams Russia, says Putin, quote, attempts to undermine America's moral authority.
I know what's wrong with that headline. It should have been Mattis, paren, who says shooting people is fun, close paren, slams Russia, says Putin attempts to undermine America's moral authority.
Perfect. That's a good edit. You should suggest that to CNN.
I know we could do 2 hours on America's moral authority or lack thereof. But it's just suffice to say that this comes during the same week when America has been ripping children from immigrants, including breastfeeding babies, Down's children syndrome, and so on. So I think the irony of Mattis claiming the high ground on America's moral authority is just...
That we don't actually have any high ground.
No.
How does the leader of Russia undermine the moral authority of the United States?
The moral authority.
How does he do it?
You should call him because you obviously
I'm curious,
are in
Steve.
Contact.
How is Putin undermining the moral authority of the United States? Like, what does he do?
He sponsors RT and Sputnik, which calls attention to the fact of America's moral failings, I believe.
There you go.
Might be...
I don't know. Anyway, yeah, you know, we did when we talked to Sloboda about the moral authority of the United States, I think we were also raising there that the United States dropped a quarter of a million pounds of napalm daily on the Korean War. But, you know, every time the U.S. does go to war, it's always for a moral reason. I mean, they never say, hey, we're going to dominate this other country and put into place a puppet government and exploit its land, labor, and resources for the benefit of our private corporations, because guess what? Nobody would support that. It's always for a good cause, and especially a moral cause.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's stick with James Mattis. This is another one which really got me, and it's more the reporters than James Mattis in this case. The headline reads, Mattis not aware of North Korea taking any steps to denuclearize.
Do you think he just stopped reading the news that week? Is that what that was?
Yeah, apparently suspending testing and destroying your nuclear testing site and your engine testing facility doesn't count for anything. But like I said, what really got me about this was not so much Mattis's answer, but the reporter asking the question. The Singapore summit was 10 days ago. Were they expecting that North Korea was going to put its nukes on a, you know, on a train and roll them into the ocean or something like that? What exactly were they expecting to happen in 10 days? I don't know.
Now, that's really going to make the ocean levels rise right there.
True enough. But Mattis is part of that military-industrial complex that actually does not want peace to break out in the Korean Peninsula. They're hoping to turn public opinion against this deal. You know, it's weird. Donald Trump is widely unpopular. I mean, the majority of the population doesn't like him or his policies, except this policy. They actually, there's a 55%, according to a recent poll, of Americans support what Donald Trump is doing at the Singapore summit.
Steve, I think your next headline is incredibly important, and I want to make sure we get to that one.
Yeah, this one was probably the most upsetting to me of all the ones, although in a way it's a good article, but it's upsetting nonetheless. Here's the headline from the Washington Post. Gazans have survived years of war. Now depression is killing them. Now, as I said, on the one hand, this is a very important issue, mental health in Gaza and Palestine in general, that has been very underreported in the press. So I'm very glad the Washington Post finally has an article about it. But this headline, Gazans have survived years of war. Well, some of them have. Thousands of them haven't. And this problem has been going on for decades without any notice from the Washington Post. So the fact that they're finally covering it with this headline is just drove me crazy, to be honest.
Absolutely. I mean, there have been surveys of children saying, you know, how the majority of children in Gaza report having nothing to look forward to, not having happiness, not being able to even, you know, have food stability. Of course, there's depression and PTSD that's been going on. But absolutely, Steve, as we've talked about on this segment before, there have been, you know, hundreds of deaths in just the past month or two, as well as multiple thousands of people injured, both with tear gas and with live ammo.
You know, I want to go back to the Korea issue, because there's another headline, Steve, that you sent that I just saw about how it ended up where the U.S. canceled the war games, which have been canceled now, the games that simulate the destruction of North Korea that were scheduled for August. This is an NBC News headline. What's that?
This is the laugh out loud headline of the week. Trump says he requested end to war games and talk with North Korea's Kim Jong-un.
That is the laugh out loud headline. Dear, listen, Mr. Kim Jong-un, can we cancel the war games that we conduct every year, twice a year, that simulate your destruction? Can we? And Kim Jong-un said, yeah, let's do that.
I'm willing.
I agree.
It was just too much to bear, really. Well, since we're on laugh out loud headlines, the next one, which doesn't come from a newspaper, it comes from the Atlanta Council, which is a major think tank, quote-unquote think tank in D.C., and it's about Ukraine, and it reads as follows. Ukraine's got a real problem with far-right violence, parentheses, and no, RT did not write this headline.
Oh my gosh, Steve, when you put this in the document, I opened the link just to see. I was like, did Steve add this in? Is this editorial commentary? No, that's actually the headline. That's the whole headline.
That is actually the headline.
And the first line of the piece, it sounds like the stuff of Kremlin propaganda, but it's not.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like articles about Black Lives Matter and all the other things they're complaining about as Kremlin propaganda. It sounds like Kremlin propaganda, but it's not. Yeah, guess what? It's not. It's real. Only they finally, you know, in this case, had to acknowledge that it's real and not just Kremlin propaganda, quote unquote.
But this isn't new.
Yeah, big surprise. There are right-wing fascist neo-Nazis in Ukraine. Like,
imagine.
I mean, I think we know that that was the armed force that overthrew the corrupt but democratically elected government of Yanukovych in February 2014, a move that was at that time hailed by the State Department as a great new day for Ukraine. And of course, we had Hillary Clinton and John McCain and the whole team of neocons cheering that on, even though the people are obviously, were obviously, the armed militias were, in fact, neo-Nazis.
And the one line from that article, which is exactly on that point, which really got to me, in that article, it says, the anti-democratic ideology these groups espouse runs counter to the values of the Euromaidan. No, it was exactly the values of the Maidan.
And just to be fair, it wasn't the values of all of the people in the Maidan.
No.
I mean, they were the ones who grabbed the leadership, and that's all important. I want to just end with one last headline that you sent, Steve. Again, going back to North Korea, as North Korea danger recedes ever so slightly, renewed Russian threat looms. Of course it does, because this week there was a vote on the defense budget.
That's right.
Let's get it up to a trillion. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much wrong with this headline. First of all, the idea that there was a North Korean danger, which is offensive and wrong. Secondly, that there's a renewed Russian threat, as if there was a Russian threat to begin with. And the whole article is about Russia's attempts to interfere with the 2018 midterms, which have been multiple articles in the press and claims about this. There's zero evidence that Russia has done anything in the 2018 election. And furthermore, this article claims that they demonstrated their ability to alter the results of the 2016 election, which was not, and nothing has been proven on that point. In fact, the original DNI report explicitly refuses to make any such claim.
We're out of time. We've been joined from the San Francisco Bay Area by Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, which you can find at Left Eye, that's L-E-F-T, the letter I.blogspot.com. We've also been joined by Nicole Rossell. She's a producer of this show. We'll be back on Monday. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and 1390 AM. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area, you can also hear us at SputnikNews.com. You can subscribe to Loud and Clear at iTunes or now at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.